Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome one and all to Trisha's True Crime Radio. I have to warn you, you need to put on your plastic ponchos because you are about to be legally gooed all over your body. Opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests. Do remember that, okay? Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from WebSleuth.com LLC and ForumsForJustice.org. In other words, if you get upset, my darling, at something that we say, I say on this show, you come to we, me, and we'll make you happy again. You don't take it out on the forums. And we have some great guests tonight. My official co-host, Michael, will tell us later on in the show about several families who raised $10,000 to buy service dogs for their handicapped kids, only to find out the dogs were not at all service dogs. They weren't even trained. The people who supplied the dogs are not talking, and now these families want answers. That's later in the show. And also a bit later, VL Pate will join us to tell us about her latest blog entry at www.re-newsit, that's newsit.com. But first, last week I received a call from a guy who wanted to tell us his story about his encounters with Martin McNeil. Now, let me tell you, they were very, very bizarre. Not surprising, but very, very, very bizarre. So we arranged for him to come on the show this week, tonight. But a few hours after I set up the interview, he called back and he was very worried. He was worried about his safety and his family's safety if McNeil was found not guilty. And he didn't want to come on the show. I don't blame him. I said, absolutely not. I totally understand. Don't do it. The stories this person told me, I can't tell you because I promised I wouldn't. I can't tell you that it would not surprise you, and the stories are very, very strange, and Martin was one very, very cold fish. Anyway, I tried to get a hold of this person today to see if maybe their minds had changed and they want to come back on the show since McNeil was found guilty, but I wasn't able to get in touch with them. I'm hoping they're listening tonight. If you are, the number to call in is 760-825-0933, and be sure and press the number that they tell you to if you want to talk to the host. That way I know you're waiting with a question or a comment, okay? Okay, now, today, we can all finally breathe a sigh of relief because Martin McNeil will not be able to kill another innocent person. Let's hope not, anyway. McNeil was found guilty of obstruction of justice and of killing his wife, Michelle, in 2007. Friends and family of Michelle were in the courtroom early Saturday morning when the verdict was read, and they let out such a cry, and who can blame them? Now, the Martin McNeil case has all these ingredients for a twisted tale of murder and betrayal. You and I know this will be, at the very least, it will become a Lifetime movie, and I bet a few books will be written as well. Now, if there are books to be written about the McNeil saga, I would hope our next guests would be the ones to write them. They are so trustworthy and so good at what they do. Ben Winslow from Fox 13 Now and Kathy from CourtChatter.com have been covering the trial daily. Their no-nonsense, yet down-to-earth reporting of the facts gives me hope that there are other decent reporters left in the world. Yes, I do hope one or both of them write a book about this case because they know all the details. Let's go to Ben Winslow first from Fox 13 Now. Ben, welcome to Trisha's True Crime Radio.
Hey, thank you for having me.
You bet. Now, let's talk about the verdict and leading up to the verdict a little bit. You were in the courtroom, obviously. When the verdict of guilty was read, and this cry, this sharp cry just came out, you knew it was from Michelle's family. When you spoke to them afterwards, tell us who you talked to and what they said.
Well, we talked to as many members of the family as we could, of course. Obviously, Alexis, who, you know, was very happy that justice was served. She was just extremely emotional, as was Linda Clough, Michelle's sister, who was also just, you know, feels like she finally got justice for her sister. You know, they were the ones who pretty much were crying in court, and you could hear them crying. I was seated in front of them in the courtroom, and you could hear them crying behind me just in the build-up as we were waiting for the jury to come in, as we were waiting for the verdict to be read. You know, and the bailiff, it was kind of interesting. The bailiff warned everybody in the courtroom prior to the verdict being read that, you know, no outbursts from the gallery because the judge will not be happy. Well, of course, you know, when you get a verdict like that, I mean, you can't contain any kind
right.
of emotion, and those women could not contain themselves. I mean, they just, you know, crying and shouting, just basically, you know, that kind of emotional outburst you know, obviously for them, relief at the verdict that was rendered.
Absolutely right. That's, I agree 100%. I'm sorry, I'm just reading something in the chat room here. Let's talk about the closing arguments for a moment, Ben, shall we? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I heard from a lot of people. This is the first time that a lot of people from around the country, well, it is the first time, that they were able to witness a Utah trial. Now, the prosecution giving his closing arguments was very calm and wasn't dramatic, didn't have flair like Jose Baez or anybody else that we have seen, but he gave the facts. Now, to me, he did a great closing argument. I'm used to this calm demeanor of just stating the facts. Did you get that that kind of buzz from other people, from especially from out of state, who were just like appalled that he wasn't getting dramatic and flailing his arms?
Yeah, you know, and that's been my experience at least through the whole trial. And you have to understand, for Utah, this is the first time, of course, a trial in Utah has been televised live.
Right.
And it, for me, who has covered courts for more than a decade now in Utah, this was pretty standard for me. This
mm-hmm.
is, you know, this is how our trials are. Our attorneys shake hands, you know, after they get done presenting their closing statements, which is what Randy Spencer did to Chad Grunander. He shook his hand after his closing statement. You know, this is just how they are in
mm-hmm.
Utah courts. And one thing I've been surprised at is kind of the level of vitriol that's been leveled against the attorneys for both sides on this. I mean, some of the comments are pretty cruel. And, you know, this is just, you know, how we do trials here. You know, it's like our attorneys are not flamboyant. They are not,
mm-hmm.
you know, outspoken. They don't flail about, you know, and they really try to just try their case.
We'll be getting into some of the evidence and why the jury did find him guilty. But let's go to my official co-host, unofficial co-host, Michael in Minnesota. He has a question for you. Michael, go ahead, my dear.
Well, I was most impressed. It's more of a statement, but I would
mm-hmm.
also, of course, like comments from Ben and Kathy. But for once, I've heard from a couple people that the way the prosecution was able to describe reasonable doubt was what made this trial easier. The two people I've spoken to that mentioned it said that they had no idea before this prosecutor's description of what reasonable doubt actually meant.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I served on a jury, I kept saying, reasonable doubt is not all doubt. And I was just, what did you think of that in particular part of his summation? Or,
you know, for me, it was the way that the prosecution took a lot of circumstantial evidence. And even they acknowledged this was a highly circumstantial case. This was going to be a difficult case to prove. And the way that they, in the closing statements, kind of took all of these pieces of circumstance and kind of put it all together, you know, saying that, and they told us outside of court that there was a mountain of motive, but it's trying to piece that all together, trying to show the jury, you know, that all of these circumstances add up to something. And that's really what they tried to do. The defense, I think, also did a very good job of highlighting all the problems with the prosecution's case. And, of course, you know, they're going to try to prove that, you know, this is not beyond a reasonable doubt. And, you know, really the closing statements on both of these were quite well done, because they both, you know, showcased the highlights of or the strong parts of each case and the weaknesses of the other.
Kathy from Courtroom Chatter, what is your thoughts on Michael's statement?
Well, about the reasonable doubt, he did lay it out sort of in layman terms, and probably those eight jurors had never really thought about what that meant.
Right.
Look, these prosecutors are really good. They are.
Yeah.
They're getting some flack out there because they're not all flamboyant and in your face and all of that. They had a case they knew was hard to prove, and they methodically went through it, put up everyone they thought they needed to, asked the questions they thought they needed to, you know, and in the end got what they needed. I agree with Ben. I thought both sides had terrific closings as far as points were made. I didn't necessarily wasn't thrilled with Randy Spencer's "when I was a young lad" and Aesop fables. I would really love to see a juror interview to see what they thought about that kind of delivery and putting that kind of thing into a closing statement. But Spencer had a lot on his side. You know, this is so circumstantial, and there was nothing putting McNeil there. So I saw that Kathy Monkman asked in the chat room about, you know, what, because the buzz was,
the case was so up in the air.
Yeah, it was so up in the air, and it was. There, you couldn't find a person all week long around that courtroom that thought they could predict this verdict, including me. It was just really, I think the defense had a good shot at this one. I think the prosecution brought it home in the end.
And I agree with you, Kathy and Ben. We all talked about this, and we all said the same thing, the exact same thing. Well, if they go by the letter of the law, they'll probably find him not guilty, but if they use their common sense, they'll find him guilty, so it's 50-50. Everybody thought that. I don't think there was one person there that was absolutely confident it was going to go one way or the other, and that's what made this case so fascinating. It was all circumstantial. It was based on testimony from a witness who was a little girl at the time, and you had to really follow Martin's train of thought and put together why he would want to kill his wife, the steps and the way he went about it, you know, lining up this plastic surgery, getting these medicines. He was a doctor. So the doctor didn't question when he got Xanax and Valium and Percocet and Lorazepam and everything else together. He gives it to her, and then she drowns in the bathtub, and then, boom, Gypsy, his the person he did this for, the woman in his life, moves in and becomes her quote-unquote nanny, but doesn't even fix the kids a bowl of cereal. So it was so hard to put together. But I want to talk about the jury for a moment, if we can, Ben. Looking at the jury, you know, I saw, like Kathy mentioned, a school teacher that wanted to bring the ruler back to knock on your knuckles. I saw a guy that looked like Bob Seger. I saw Tom Petty with longer hair. I saw Mr. Nice, Good Neighborhood Guy who could fix your truck. I mean, they were all there, and I'm dying to talk to one of them. Now, the judge gave the jury a list of media contacts, and if they wanted to talk to the media, they would call the media. I take it nobody's been called. Is that right, Ben?
My phone, I'm still waiting for it to ring. You know, I do think that eventually some jurors will talk. At what point that is, I don't know. But, of course, this is a tough thing. You sat through a month of legal arguments. You missed your entire life for this case.
Right.
And so, I understand the judge wanting to kind of give them some breathing room. Of course, I do expect at some point we'll hear from them, and it will be fascinating to know, you know, what was the piece of evidence or what was the argument that was most compelling to them, what put them over, you know, and what did they disregard? Because, you know, there were a lot of holes in this case, and there were some witnesses that you could argue were less than truthful at any point. And so it will be fascinating to know what went on in that room. I'm kind of curious where that jury question that came from about inheritance and who stood to win. They wanted to look at Michelle's clothing. They asked for a calculator, whether that was to calculate BMI or travel distance to somebody's house and work. We don't know. And then the 911 call. They wanted that 911 call, and they went so far as to tell the judge, that is the last piece of evidence we need to render a verdict. Which put the prosecution and the defense, they both jumped on that to get them that tape.
And why do you think that is? Tell us about the 911 call. Let's go to Ben first, then Kathy will go to you. What was in that 911 call? Give us kind of the breakdown.
Well, it's Martin calling for help, saying that his wife, is in the bathtub or was in the bathtub. He's screaming in that. He hangs up on the dispatcher, there was kind of an interesting moment early on in the trial when they initially played the 911 call. The prosecution had claimed that Martin McNeil didn't give a complete address or had given the wrong address, and then Randy Spencer got up and slowed it down for the dispatcher, and you could hear that he had actually given the correct address. He just said it so fast it didn't pick up.
Right.
So, I think the jury just wanted to hear it again. I don't know if it speaks to motive, if they wanted to hear it again to verify if he was, overdramatic acting, or if they wanted to maybe exclude something, you know, maybe for the defense, saying, well, this shakes out. Don't know. I mean, obviously, once we talk to a juror, we'll know.
Kathy, what do you think?
I thought the two questions and the one request were just odd. Knowing what we know now and how the verdict came down, I still can't wrap my head around them. When they came with the first question about Utah state law and would the surviving spouse inherit the estate regardless of what a will said, we just all started chattering about that after because, you know, we had hours there to try
right.
and
so
many figure
hours.
Out. Yeah, so many. Try to break down and figure out what could they be thinking, like what argument could be going on in there that it matters whether or not someone gets that house in the death or not, because that really had nothing to do with what the supposed motive was here. You know, so that was confusing to me. I'd love to hear what they had to say about that. The 911 tape, we had a lot of time to sit and kind of chat about that because they came back saying that the copy they were given couldn't be played back there in the jury room, that the mm-hmm. whatever, the thing wasn't right. And so, you know, we're late at night now, and the prosecutors have to run back to their office and try and make a better copy. And so we have lots of time where we're just kind of sitting around there talking about why would they want the 911 type tape. And then when the judge gave them the opportunity to go home and come back the next day, and they said, the exact wording, I think, was the 911 tape is the last piece of evidence we want, and then we will have a verdict. Not we might,
wow.
not we may. So to me, their mind was already made up. So I don't know why they needed the 911 tape. I don't think that made a difference one way or the other. I think maybe they wanted to cover, they were doing their due diligence and cover all their bases and going through all the evidence. They had, they took 11 hours to go through everything. The 911 tape could have been, since we now know that they came to a guilty verdict, mm-hmm. could be just reaffirming in their minds that about how he was acting and why, he said, I'm performing CPR right now. How can you be doing that when she was still in the tub and you're on the phone with 911, things like that.
And the thing is, when you have somebody's life in your hands, even though it wasn't a death penalty case, you still have someone's life in your hands. You want to make darn sure, that's how we swear in Utah, we say darn and flip. You want to make darn sure that you are correct in coming to your conclusion. And I think that's what it was. I think they had probably gone around the table, all said guilty, but just to, so they didn't lose any sleep at night, they had to listen to that 911 call. Michael in Minnesota, what is your question or comment?
Do we know the clothes that the jurors wanted to handle? I understand from testimony that there were clothes found in the garage soaking wet. Were those part of the evidence?
That's what the jury wanted to see. Yeah, that was Michelle's clothing.
The only clothing evidence that came into the trial were a black long sleeve top, a white LDS garment top, and a white bra. Those are the only three items. Towels and all that weren't brought in.
The wet things that were found in the garage were not admitted into evidence?
Those were found in the garage, those three items, in a big pile of towels and stuff. So in between Michelle being taken to the hospital, at some point somebody had gathered up everything and put it in a pile in the garage. And
it was
so,
Rachel.
Yes.
She was the one who testified that she had saved the clothing.
Well, she found them there and then saved them.
True.
But I don't think we know who put them in the garage. Rachel found them and was all upset that her mom's clothes had some blood on them and were just, you know how dramatic she was, were just in a pile of bloody clothing and towels. And so she took them and she washed them because she says her dad wanted her to throw them away. And she didn't want to throw away anything of her mother's. And so she washed them because she didn't want to store them with blood on them. And mm-hmm. that's why they were still around for the jury to look at.
And why do you think – I still don't understand why the jury would want to look at them. I don't get that. Any thoughts?
Just that maybe they just wanted to go over the last pieces of evidence. They had all of the evidence in the case at mm-hmm. their disposal, and the exhibits weren't many. I think there was only – altogether with the paperwork and everything – 50-something exhibits that were entered into the record from both sides. So they had it all at their disposal. I think they just wanted to maybe just look at it. We're not sure if they looked at all the document evidence already or what.
If it was me, there was so much testimony about what she was wearing and conflicting testimony. And if I'm one of those jurors, I just want to pull it out and look at it. You know, I don't know that it means one thing one way or the other.
Could be
but
just
a chance to see it. And no two witnesses really could agree on what she was wearing.
Right.
Ah,
yeah,
there you
go. That was interesting. Yeah.
That is very interesting. Let's talk about a kind of lighter, bizarre moment that happened during the deliberations, and that was we're looking at the beautiful Utah seal, state seal, and then it falls, and you're like, what is there, you know?
At the stroke of midnight.
I know.
It was right at midnight.
I was expecting some superhero to come crashing through the wall. I don't know why, but I sat there looking at it going, what is going on? What am I seeing? Kathy, tell us a little bit about that moment. Tell us what happened.
Well, you have to remember at this point, any of us that are in the courtroom are exhausted. And
Loopy.
So a little bit, even though this is a very, very serious time, a little bit of silliness had come into that courtroom, even a little bit with some of Michelle's family members, just because everyone is so delirious. It's midnight. Everyone's been there since 8 o'clock in the morning. And so there was a little bit of just silliness, giggling, joking kind of going on. And then we're just all sitting there, and no one is by there. The seal is behind the judge's bench. No one is anywhere near that side of the courtroom, nobody. No clerk, bailiff, no judge, nobody. It's completely empty, and just media, family, and a couple of spectators are sitting in the gallery. And out of nowhere, that thing just falls off the wall. Just falls. There was no wall bumped. There was nothing going on. No one's there. Just falls. And we look up, and it's exactly midnight. It was just one of those kind of things that happen.
Exactly. I that was just so bizarre. And that they finally got it up, but, I mean, they had to go get tools and
they
everything.
A screw and a drill and everything, yeah.
Took two of them.
Oh, that is so – it was just – one of the more bizarre things I've ever seen, you know, and nobody knew what to say or do, and it really changed the mood in the courthouse, it looked like. There was a woman really at the center of Martin McNeil's murdering his wife, Michelle, and her name was Gypsy Willis, and what I can only describe her as a piece of work. That is the way to do it. She is a piece of work. But before I get to that, I want to go to Michael. Michael, you have something you need to you want to add before I get into Gypsy. Go for it.
Well, we started this conversation with the verdict and the, you know, we've kind of skipped over the entire week of testimony, and I wondered if either Kathy or Ben should maybe summarize what happened in court for the week leading up to the.
That's a great idea. Ben, why don't you go ahead? Can you give us kind of a Reader's Digest version of maybe the highlights of the week? And there were quite a few of them, so it's going to be hard to pick. But, you know,
I'd have to say the biggest testimony was the inmates. And that was what everybody was expecting and waiting on was the inmates who were offering at various levels statements that Martin McNeil had made. But their testimony was really suspect because, you know, it as it came across through the cross-examination, each one of these guys on some level wanted something for their testimony. I mean, the inmate number one who had the most damning statements that Martin McNeil allegedly said was one who had coined the term Operation Utah in contact with his family, that he was offering his testimony so that he could get out of prison and he was going to be home under someone's tree for Christmas. And the defense really just kind of hammered at him. And then Jason Poirier, who testified that Martin McNeil had made, you know, similarly damaging statements, you know, he was actually caught lying on the stand about certain things. The defense caught him in several lies. Right there on the witness stand. So, you know, it remains to be seen, of course, how seriously the jury took their testimony, because each one of them, while they had damaging things to say, they were also not, you know, shall we say, clean witnesses here. They all had, they were in it for something, while the prosecution made it clear over and over they were not offered anything for it, they were certainly thinking they were going to get something for it, which makes their entire testimony suspect. But then I think, you know, the prosecution, of course, wanted to finish big with the woman who they say is the motive for the murder of Michelle McNeil.
That's what I think the biggest part of the week was her
conduct. That's what I was just getting to, right. Let's talk about that.
And having her read those love letters on the stand, you know, which you could tell she did not want to read those.
Right.
It was deeply personal. It was slightly embarrassing. But the prosecutor, Sam Peet, just had her keep on reading. You know, stood over her shoulder or sat there and you know, just kind of put his head on his hand, and she's just reading these deeply personal letters for the jury, just to kind of make their case that this is the person that Martin McNeil was killing his wife for.
And the thing is, in case any of our listeners missed this, Gypsy Willis, the prosecution believes, and I think everybody does, was the reason that Martin McNeil decided to kill his wife. He wanted to be with Gypsy, and they were two peas in a pod, man. I mean, she was in prison, I think, for forgery, if I am not mistaken. I mean, they're just to me, in my opinion...
Well, that was what they did together, Trisha.
Together, right, together.
Yeah.
I mean, they committed crimes together. And what was so interesting is she told the judge before she was sent away that she no longer had anything to do with Martin McNeil. That relationship was over. And when they brought up these letters that she was receiving from McNeil, and she had written to McNeil, it was all, "My darling, my love," and he's saying, "I can't wait to be with you." And her explanation, Gypsy Willis's explanation in court as to why she told the judge one thing, that they were done, and why she wrote him back, she was lonely. She was in prison. She had no one. No one was visiting her. She was desperate. Oh, my God, she is so full of it. It drives me nuts. I mean, I just wanted to stand up and say, are you crazy? Nobody buys this. Okay, I'll calm down. Kathy, your thoughts.
Okay, so, yes, I think, Gypsy, this is what I think. Up until that last day, this case was totally up in the air. Those first three inmates and Jason Poyer, the former inmate, I think did nothing to help the state.
I agree.
I think Alexis was the best witness. Other than that, the rest was kind of all over the place. Didn't see a super strong case, and even the first time Gypsy testified. But bringing her back and reading those love letters, and those love letters are, "I hope you know that I love you and think about you all the time. We can worry about all that later when I'm closer to you and when I can see you. Let's get married and shut these people up once and for all."
Yeah,
this is
yeah.
what's going on. This is what's going on right after Michelle's dead, and they're both sitting in separate prisons, okay? And Gypsy was the key to this whole case, because that's the motive. And when Chad Grenander, in his closing argument, drove that home, I thought that this is it. There was an email sent on March 13th, 2007.
Mm-hmm.
Michelle was killed April 11th, so less than a month later. And the emails from Gypsy to a man that she had sort of been seeing. And she says, "A best friend has become much more than that. I met him online a year and a half ago. We've always been great together. But just recently, his reasoning and views have changed, and we are now together." This is less than a month before Michelle dies.
Wow.
Things have changed. The relationship has changed. And Grenander drove that home to the jury. This is when the plan was set in action. Things had changed. They wanted to be together. And he says, "Don't be fooled by her act." And then he brings up a blown-up picture of the military ID application. After Michelle's dead, they try and get a military ID for Gypsy so she can get on base, you know, to do whatever. And
mm-hmm.
they have to put themselves out as if they're married. And they both sign that, and they have to say they're married, and so they have to put a marriage date, and both of them choose to put the date of Michelle's funeral as their marriage date. He drove that home, and it was blown up big in the courtroom. So Gypsy is what I think the jurors are the most, Alexis and Gypsy, and it wasn't just his testimony, it was her actions that prosecutors were able to show that probably sealed McNeil's fate.
I agree. And that when I heard that in the courtroom, that they put down, you know, this fake marriage thing, they chose the same day as Michelle's funeral, that just made me sick. Ben, I know you have to go, but let me just go to you for a final comment on Gypsy here. Why didn't the prosecution charge her? It just seems so obvious that she knew what the plan was.
Well, I did talk to the prosecution afterward, after court was over, and you know, on the record, and asked them about, why didn't you look at, you know, are you looking at whether Gypsy should be charged, because there was, I mean, they asked for the judge to treat her like a hostile witness because they said it was clear she was protecting him. You know,
mm-hmm.
there's, you know, she was given an immunity deal actually the last day that she testified because things that she was about to testify to would put her in jeopardy of the plea deal she struck for testimony in the first place, because she had told police she'd broken it off, and they were going to introduce these letters showing clearly you had not. So, you know, I did ask him, are you looking at Gypsy Willis for any kind of criminal charges for her maybe less than truthful testimony? And what they said is, we'll see. So,
really?
You know, there is a chance that they could look at that and you know, review whether or not she perjured herself on the witness stand. Perjury, it's difficult because you have, when you're testifying in a court of law, you're testifying to the best of your recollection.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one could argue there are so many instances for perjury on both sides in this case.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the question that comes down to is it really worth it? Attorneys I've talked to say it's really tough to prove perjury in a trial because unless it's so blatant, you just have to lay up such a big case.
Exactly.
You know, and most people are trying to, you know, just saying, well, I didn't remember. At the time, this was a six-year-old. This happened 6 years ago. I don't remember everything that I ate for dinner that night or, you know, anything like that. So, you know, whether or not it actually comes to fruition, I don't know. We'll have to see if they have enough to even bring any type of a case. But I thought it was very interesting that the prosecution did tell me that, you know, we'll see.
That leaves me hopeful. Yeah.
Yeah, it leaves everybody hopeful, I think. Well, Ben Winslow from Fox 13 Now, you do have to run, and I will excuse you from class, but we'll have you on again real soon, okay?
So, all right, take care.
Thank you, everybody. Ben Winslow, Fox 13 Now. You can go to fox13now.com and check out Ben's story and reporting. It's amazing. Take care, my dear. Bye-bye.
All right, take care.
Bye, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
Bye, Kathy,
what are you going to do with yourself now that the trial is over?
There's always going to be something, right?
Well, there is. Utah is always full of very interesting and unique cases. You just need to find them out. Let's talk a little bit about the jury. I sat and watched the jury. I was in court two times. I could never get a read on the McNeil jury. They all were stoic. Sometimes they'd lean forward, you know, and I'm sure they didn't like being looked at like a mouse under a microscope, you know, trying to figure out where they're going in the maze. I mean, I was just sit there staring at them. Did they ever show any emotion? Did you ever get any ideas from the jury at all?
Not a peep, nothing until the state's closing. And during Prosecutor Grenander, I tweeted out about this. The gentleman in the front row middle, who always kind of had a little bit of a red face, he wore glasses, and he was visibly upset during that closing. It looked like, not upset angry, almost upset crying.
Mm-hmm.
And
really?
That was during the state's closing. And that is the first time I had seen any little hint from any of them, except for during some of the late afternoon cross-examination, there was lots of yawning and shifting in seats, that kind of thing. But as far as what way are we leaning, what's going on, that's the first thing I saw from them. That same juror, when they came back in at 1 a.m. with their verdict, they walked in, and he looked like he came in, he had his arms folded, he sat down with his arms folded, and looked, all I can say is visibly upset. I didn't see tears or anything like that, but I think maybe it had taken its toll on him. I'd like to hear what he has to say about that. But he's the only one that really showed emotion. There was reports coming out of the courtroom that there was a juror that was nodding all the time for the defense.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just that simply wasn't true. And I'll tell you why. I originally thought that. My friend and I had attended the first day, and she had mentioned, you know, you see him nodding? He's nodding in agreement. And so I watched him. He's the one I called the hippie juror.
Right,
so
the
long-haired
guy.
From that, yes, not the real long. The real long was Kid Rock, the young guy. He was excused as an alternate. But this was the guy on the end back row that I think that he was really into. He took a lot of notes. He was very, very interested. But he nodded a lot, so when I started to really watch him for the next few days, it was almost like some kind of involuntary reaction he had to things. And I don't want to call it a tick, but he was kind of a head nodder. So
right.
it wasn't really in agreement for one side or the other, and it came at random times for both sides. So I don't think that report was true. He was never pro-defense, in my view. I didn't see mm-hmm. any of the jurors give away anything about how they were leaning.
And that's what I loved about this jury. Again, it was up in the air. You couldn't find anybody in that courtroom in the McNeil trial that could definitely say, well, yeah, I really feel confident going in. Nobody knew. Michael, do you have any other
Nobody.
Questions, my dear?
Yeah, I would like to know, after the verdict was read and then the jurors were polled, was any emotion notable at that point?
From the jurors?
Right. Right.
No, except the one. And he still wasn't, like, super emotional, but you could tell that I think maybe exhaustion or it had taken its toll, or he knew the severity of what was going to happen, or he felt for the family, something. I desperately want to hear from that juror because I can't decide what his reaction was really, but he had a reaction. Other than that, everybody was very stoic. Now, by the way, Ben's not here anymore. He owes me lunch now because I called who the jury foreman was going to be. Day
oh,
one,
did?
30 minutes into opening, the jury, 30 minutes into opening statements, I tweeted to Ben who I thought it was going to be, and it was the gentleman on the back row, the furthest from the gallery.
Oh, okay,
always dressed
right.
nice, had a shirt and
right.
tie on most of the time. You know who I'm talking about.
I do.
He was the foreman, and so when the judge asked him, "Who's the foreman? Have you reached a verdict?" When he had to answer just a couple of little things when they came back in, he was a little voice cracking, a little timid, like, mm-hmm. man, you know, this is a big deal kind of thing. And so he also showed just a little bit. But when they were polled and they each had to say, they were just kind of quiet, but they just said, you know, answered yes when they were going through polling the jury. And I just think, I'm so impressed. But you know what? I'm almost always impressed with jurors.
Mm-hmm.
Because you think that, I don't know, you think that they would go home and listen to everything and read everything, you know, because that's how my brain works.
Right.
I want to know everything about cases. And you just find most of the time they don't. They really do their job. They take it seriously. And they know that in this case that somebody's life is in their hands and also
mm-hmm.
somebody died. And so the jury was this weird mix of what I would call straight-laced preppy right on down to the hippie. It was just kind of
mm-hmm.
all over the board and everybody, and they all took it equally seriously, I think.
And that is what is great about this jury, and you're right. Like I said earlier, you know, you can sit there and judge a jury and say, oh, I would never do that, but when you get there, and Michael, you've been on a jury, you know this. You have somebody's life in your hands, even if it's a few years in prison, that can ruin a person's life. You take that charge of following the directions very seriously. But Kathy, Michael, and I were talking about this off the air. Don't you think that, I mean, and this is impossible for you to say yes or no, but I just wonder if maybe somebody in the jury went home and kind of peeked on the internet. Do you ever wonder that?
Are you talking to me? I'm sorry, I didn't know
yes,
if it was Michael.
Yes. That's, no, it was you.
Well,
I was talking
yes,
to you.
Of course. Now, come on.
Mm-hmm.
Jurors are humans, right? So
right.
I really, as much as I really want to believe they follow completely to the letter, this is a big deal. They're from Utah County, which is a small place. This is all over everything. Their spouses, their mothers, their fathers, their children, everybody knows what's going on and knows that their family member's on the jury. And I have to try and picture myself. Now, I get it. My brain is different because I'm so passionate about the law and trials and stuff. But you know, how do they come home at night and get no little comments from somebody, just little teeny thing out there to put some plants in their mind? I don't think they go out purposely seeking information,
mm-hmm.
But I don't know how it's to be avoided, like in a case like this.
Yeah, exactly. Everywhere you turn, people are talking about it. If you're not on TV or a computer, when you go out, people are talking about it. So, well, I think we can pretty much wrap it up here, and I'm glad to say that we can wrap it up with a guilty verdict. Now, sentencing is going to be in January. Can you tell us what we can expect as far as what the leeway the judge has in the sentencing? Because he was convicted on the murder charge and obstruction of justice, right?
Right, right. The obstruction is like a minimum of 5 years, but the murder is 15 to life. I was a little shocked by the 15. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I thought
scary.
It was 25 to life, but it's 15 to life, and there will be a possibility of parole. But the judge will have his discretion. They will allow victim impact statements, and so fully expect to see Michelle's family get up there. I don't think there'll be anyone testifying for him, giving a statement for him. Never saw a soul come to the courtroom for him, so I don't know
never
if he
did.
Has anyone left in his life that will get up and make a statement for him. So 15 to life, he's late 50s, so I think we can pretty much close the door on him.
Yes.
And that'll happen on January 7th.
Mm-hmm. And so yeah,
we got one more thing coming up for him.
What's that?
There's sexual assault charges coming up in December.
Oh, that's right. Tell us about that. I totally forgot.
Well, there's not a whole lot known. So Ben and I actually chatted about this today, and he's going to pull the documents tomorrow and get a better look at it. Several people have accused him of some kind of sexual assault, if not officially accused him, have said it, talked to the family about it, whatever. Alexis has come straight out and said that her father touched her inappropriately twice after her mother's death.
Mm-hmm.
And then a coworker, okay? And then there was somebody else, a former patient. So there's a sexual assault charge that's supposed to be heard in December. I don't know that that means it's the trial or anything like that. But we're all not clear on who that victim is.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know who this is going to officially be on. And we don't know if the person is going to end up dropping it because he's now going to be gone away for life. You know, so, or, you know, most of his life, whatever. But that is scheduled in December. So I'll definitely keep on top of that and be writing about what will happen with that and be there for sure. It was a two-day hearing or trial scheduled in the 1st of December.
And I'll be there with you. We can go eat lunch again at Sensuous
That's
Sandwiches.
Right.
That was delicious.
So good, isn't it?
Here in Provo, go to Sensuous Sandwiches. Michael in Minnesota, any follow-up questions before we let Kathy go and back to her family and get back to her life finally?
Well, I am still curious about the jurors, Kathy. When they were walking out or at any time, did you see any of them make eye contact with either Martin or the McNeil children, adult children, anybody?
During the verdict time?
And as they were leaving or any time.
Okay, any time walking in and out, never. They looked forward to the jury box walking in, looked forward to the door that they go out looking at. I never, and I always tried to look very carefully at those moments. As far as just being in the jury box during the entire testimony, there would be some looking around. There are a few people that never looked around. They were either looking at the attorney or the witness or the judge, never looked around. But that young guy that I labeled Kid Rock, he looked at Martin McNeil all the time. He always had, and I wouldn't just say, you know, just stared him down all the time, but for the most out of all the jurors, he would just kind of look over there and glance at him, especially I noticed when they would talk about the love letters and Gypsy, and he would just kind of, like, look over at him. And then he also looked at the gallery a lot. So he had a lot of wandering eye going on and looked around. The rest of them really didn't. They really didn't look around. They were just always looking at what they were supposed to be looking at the whole time.
And then after the verdict was read and they were leaving for the final time, did they ever make eye contact with the McNeils or give a nod of, we
nothing
did it for you or anything?
Nothing. They walked out, nothing. And then I don't know if you guys heard this. They met with the family that night.
Yeah.
Did you hear about that?
Oh,
I did.
I didn't, no.
Okay,
and
so I'm sorry.
I was going to say, do we know anything about that? Tell us.
Yeah, well, this is just, we don't know a whole lot, but after a little bit of the media got done and stuff, they opened up a separate courtroom and allowed the family to go in there with the prosecutors, and they asked if they wanted to speak to the jury, that the jury was all still there, and the family wanted to talk to them, and they said, of course. And so let me just read this, and I'll read it. I'll give another site a plug because it's from Michelle's family that created the site, martinmcneil.info, and this is what she writes. She says, afterward, a courtroom down the hall was opened up for us to all convene. We all clapped and cheered for the investigators and prosecution as they walked in. They asked if we would like to meet the jurors, and of course we said yes. It was a very special moment as the jurors walked in and we were again clapping and cheering. Those eight individuals saw the impact it had on all of us and how happy we were with their decision and thus finally giving Michelle the justice she has deserved. We had an opportunity to talk to them and personally thank them. Amazing. So they didn't talk about what they said to them, but they had that moment with all the jurors, even though at this point it's the middle of the night. All the jurors stayed, apparently.
Oh, that isn't that nice?
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
That is fantastic. It just shows that was an amazing group of people. Well, Kathy, your blog, courtshatter.com, is one of my favorites, and dare I say Michael's favorites now. We go to it all the time. What's next on your court docket that you're going to be reporting on?
Well, I'm going to – this is what I do when I'm – you know, there's nothing going on live here in Utah. I'm always watching a trial. There's usually something live streaming going on. I watch it through a site called whoopwhoop.tv.
Right.
And so on Thursday, a few days ago, a trial started in Florida, Jason Rodriguez. And so this weekend I've been catching up on YouTube, the testimony for the first 2 days, and I'll begin to watch that this week. And then I'll just do some research and write some recaps and some buzz about it on my blog. He went into his old work and shot up the place, killed a man and shot five others, and there's no argument that he did it, his claiming insanity. So
really?
he claims he has a chip that was placed in his head, and he hears voices.
Oh,
so
man.
This is very interesting. So I've just gotten into it. I've just gotten through opening statements and the first two witnesses, and so that's what I'm going to be doing the next week or so, however long that one lasts.
What jurisdiction is that in, Kathy?
I'm sorry, what?
What jurisdiction is that in Florida?
That's in Florida. Oh, that's a good question. I don't know, Michael. I've been so wrapped up in McNeil that I'm not sure the exact jurisdiction it's in. I'm sure somebody's telling us right now in chat, but...
Yeah. I swear we have the smartest chatters. We do. I love them. Scorekeeper has a question. Let's see. Question. Where is the question, Scorekeeper? He has one. Which alternate juror came back for the final verdict? Do you know that, Kathy?
I do not know. No, I didn't see that. I heard about that after the fact, so I don't know who it was.
Ah, interesting. Well, I think we're going to hear a lot more. And, Kathy, have you ever thought about writing a book? I think you'd be fantastic, you and Ben together.
Oh, that would be fun, wouldn't it?
It would be
Maybe
great.
Maybe we'll
and
see.
I will take full credit, of course, for that book if it ever happens because I suggested it. So, anyway, Kathy at courtchatter.com, thank you so much. It was such a delight meeting you, and I'm sure we'll meet again because there are always strange cases in Utah to observe in the courtroom. Take care, my dear, and we'll talk to you soon, okay?
Bye-bye, Tricia and Michael.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you so much for everything.
You're welcome.
Oh, wow, Michael, this was a good ending. We can feel good about the system working this time, the jurors using their common sense and finding Martin McNeil guilty of killing his wife, Michelle, and obstruction of justice, and we still have those sexual abuse charges to look forward to. So we'll keep on top of that, right? Are you there, Michael?
Yes, absolutely. Okay.
Good,
absolutely.
Good, good. Okay, Michael, you called me the other night quite late, very upset about a story that you heard. It came out of, was it Wisconsin, I believe?
Well, actually, there were local families. It aired on my local news.
Okay, and tell us about
it. Twin Cities, Minnesota, not Michigan. And, oh, Tricia, you are right. I was so upset.
You were upset.
But it motivated me to get busy and try to help these families, but... yes, it's about the service dogs that you referenced in your...
Tell us about that. Little... These service dogs are not service dogs. Give us the beginning, middle, and ending to this story, and I promise you people, blood will be spurting from your eyes. You'll be so angry.
Okay, well, these poor families, okay, there were two families profiled, and one has a child with autism, and the other family has a child with Angelman's syndrome, which is not something I've ever heard of, but I have since checked it out on Google. And it's marked that their six-year-old child with Angelman's can only laugh and nod his head and smile. They're known to have high energy, but they cannot communicate. They're locked. They're locked. They'll never progress. They'll never speak. He'll be a one-year-old, essentially, for the rest of his life.
So tragic.
So these families wanted to get these service dogs to help them with. Service dogs have been shown to really be beneficial for children with autism. They can calm them down. They can sense things before they happen. They can essentially guide them through their life, and it can really be a huge relief for these families. And then with Angelman's, it was the Holtman family's hope that this dog would be able to communicate for their son with Angelman's. And so there's a three-year wait from our local service dog provider, the leading local service dog provider, because each dog really is trained specifically for whatever disability they are going to. A person in a wheelchair, you know, a quadriplegic or an elderly or something, will have different needs, obviously, than an autistic child or a child with Angelman's or whatever it would be.
Right.
So they train the dog specifically for each individual who will be receiving, and it takes up to 3 years. Over 900 hours goes into training these dogs. Well, the families, of course, wanted to bypass that, and so they went online and found this Compassionate Paws, which is located in Wisconsin. And each family had to do several fundraisers in different states to come up with a $10,000 price tag to buy these service dogs. These dogs arrived without the ability to even follow the simple commands of sit, come, stay, and one of the two dogs was not even house trained. Peed all over the house and ripped furniture to pieces and actually bit the autistic child.
And let's back up here. Excuse me. They paid $10,000 a piece for these dogs. $10,000. And they wanted to bypass the three-year waiting period, which is understandable. But when they did that, they chose somebody that was not reputable. And I don't know if there was any way to search. What was the name of the organization they chose, Michael?
Compassionate Paws.
Compassionate Paws.
Right. And now since there is a lawsuit against Compassionate Paws, and there are 23 people enjoined in that action against Compassionate Paws, the Wisconsin Attorney General is investigating these charges. But no one will answer any of their queries. When the reporter went to the home of the owner, the husband of the owner said, get off my property. And as the reporters were leaving, there were actually shots fired.
Shot at. The reporters
were
shot
at. I'm not saying they were shot at, but shots were fired, and they're audible in the piece. Mm-hmm. And I can post a link to all of this because the story still appears in the video. It's only 7 minutes long, but in 7 minutes you will be so outraged. So these poor families, I just need to, everybody, if you need a service dog, there are places to get an accredited service dog. But there are shysters out there who can sell these supposed service dogs that haven't been trained. And in my correspondence with the families who purchased these dogs, they each said that the dogs show signs of abuse. So in addition to not even being trained, yes, they've been abused as well. So it made my blood boil. You know, Tricia, like I said to you, I know criminal elements obviously lack a filter, but for some reason you would think our disabled and vulnerable citizens would be somehow safe from these cons, but they are actually targeted, and I can't imagine what kind of It's a subhuman that could take advantage of a person.
Of something like that. And the fact that, and I did post the link to the video that you sent me, Michael. I posted it in the chat room. And the fact that you see the reporter going there, and she's very polite and saying, we just want to talk to the woman, and it was the woman's husband. And he just said, get out. And then a few minutes later, you hear shots being fired. That really shows they have something to hide. We have a question from Scorekeeper, and she wants to know, where are the dogs now? Aren't they all with the family still, or did they anybody get rid of their dogs?
The Wisconsin family said it's not the dog's fault. They plan on keeping it. But the Walrus with the autistic child, to get rid of it, it's so difficult. As anyone who's lived with a disabled person knows, your life is so turned upside down in just day-to-day living. It's a complicated existence. And you can't have a dog that is older and untrained. It's hard to break old habits. And who has the time or patience when all of your energy is going to your disabled child? So
exactly. Go ahead.
I know the Walrus are getting rid of their dog. And in that report, didn't Liz Collins is a reporter, and I believe Liz said that most of the families have to give the dogs to a humane society or a shelter because they just can't have, it's not a service animal, it's another burden.
I was going to say, that is the worst thing you could do. These dogs are big. They're big dogs. And if that dog isn't trained...
Great Pyrenees, aren't they?
Yeah, Great Pyrenees. They're huge. Yeah. I mean, they're knocking the kids down. They're peeing on the floor. It's the worst thing you could do to a family that is already dealing, like you said, Michael, with a disabled child. There is so much stress, and so much of your life goes into taking care of that child. You've just let another, 150-pound toddler into your life with four paws, and it's not
right.
trained. And the thing is, it's what's interesting is when you go to this site that I posted, the news report, and they have a little clip from the training people from the Compassionate Paws.
Compassionate Paws, yeah.
Yeah, they have a little training clip. And it shows them leading a dog, and they've got a piece of food in their hand, and the dog's following them. And then they interview an expert, and he says, anybody could get a dog to follow you with food. That's nothing.
No, it doesn't show anything.
It shows absolutely nothing. And this gentleman that was interviewed, he runs a very reputable service dog center where they do train the animals, and there is a 3-year waiting list. And he said that it's just so easy because these people are so desperate. They can't wait 3 more years. They need help now. And these people promise that their dogs will do it. Oh, and here's the excuse that Compassionate Paws gave through their lawyer, and this is what gets me. The training still needs to continue at home. It doesn't end after you pick up the dog. And it's like, yeah, it kind of does. Maybe you need to train it to work with you a little bit, but the dog should already know what to do. You don't have time to train the dog. Michael, what is next? You're really following the story. I know you're trying to help. You're very compassionate and very generous, and you're trying to help these people. What's the latest? What's going on next?
Well, I have contacted the Can Do Canine, which is the man. I contacted the executive director who was interviewed in the piece to see if there was any way to expedite, if there was some way that we could get a dog named for these families, and I would, give them the donation to cover any expenses to hopefully get them a dog sooner than later. But the problem is, they have a limited number of trainers, and as he said in the piece, they have a 3-year waiting period. So he is helping, trying to locate another place that he would feel confident recommending. So there are people working on trying to get these as family dogs, and I've assured them that it won't cost them anything, that come hell or high water, I will try to get them a dog
in a
timely fashion.
Sweet.
But I do not want another fiasco on their hands. I know how to train a dog to be a good pet, but I certainly don't have the skills to train a dog to pick up keys and open doors and alert a parent to when the child has to go to the bathroom. I wish I did, and I would train the dog myself. But It's such a tragic story. I just couldn't believe it.
It is, and I believe the Attorney General in those states are looking into it, if I'm not mistaken. Cinderella wants to know, would a letter-writing campaign help anywhere? I don't think so, because I think the authorities, maybe I'm wrong, Michael, but I think the authorities are already aware of it. What needs to happen is it needs to be kept in the public eye, and pressure needs to be kept on the authorities to get this place shut down and try and get some of their money back, right?
Right, right, exactly. The families that the Walraffs, in fact, I put them in touch with Beth Karras, and Beth is actually doing a radio show on Tuesday, and I wish I knew where to send our listeners to hear, but she is actually going to talk to the Walraff family, or Walraff family, and it's their ultimate goal that no one else gets taken by compassionate pause. And
right.
So they want national attention on this issue, and I don't know how else to do that. I talked to Sky today, and she's going to alert Dr. Drew's producer to the story so he can hopefully get Dr. Drew to talk about it. And I just don't. We've got to get the word out that this is happening, first of all, and that the most vulnerable of our citizens need to be so wary, which is
absolutely
tragic.
We do have a question from the chat room. Can the dogs that the families receive not be trained for their original purpose? And I guess they could, but you have to find a trainer. And that's where
the
problem is.
Well, like I said, though, they're already so old. Now, I know from Can Do Canines, the reputable place here, they do have foster families that will take in puppies and just try to get them socialized and, you know, trained, housebroken, and the basic commands. But really, it takes a certain skill set to, when a dog is two or three, as you know, now, when I rescued Vinny, he was already two, they think. Of course, you don't know, and he was terribly damaged, and it took a solid year for him to trust me. I couldn't train him on a simple thing like an invisible fence without him just cowering because he was so beaten down.
Oh.
So I don't think you can start with a damaged dog. And like I said, these families report that these dogs show signs of having been abused. And I think it's really hard to teach an abused dog new tricks. So I don't know that it's an ideal candidate for these programs because I don't think they, with a three-year wait, they don't have time to break a lot of old habits and try to train a dog that has missed that window of really being a success story.
Exactly.
That's
my understanding.
Take,
and that's what I understand, too. They usually take these dogs as puppies. Now, I know they sometimes go around, and I'm talking about the service dogs here in Utah. I know a couple of people that train them, and they go to the shelters a lot of times to find a good dog.
Right.
But the dog's got to have the right personality, and you're right, Michael, the last thing they want is a dog that's been abused because that's a real extra thick layer that you don't have time to work with, and it may not ever work anyway. So we will keep on top of this, but I posted the link in the chat room. If you just Google Compassionate Paws, I think the story will come up, but we'll keep you updated on this. And Michael, thank you. You do, like somebody said in the chat room, you rock, and you really do. You're an angel. Thank you so much. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
You can't help but be moved by some of these stories. Like,
I know.
I don't know how people can. I'm glad I don't watch the news nightly. I was telling my mom the story, and she said, "You better not watch the news. You'll run out of money."
You'll die. Yeah. It's too much. It's a good idea, Michael. You can only take on so much to save the world. So you certainly are doing more, much more than your fair share. VL Pate was going to be on tonight, but she's going to be on next week and to talk about her blog. But Michael, I told you earlier who's going to be on next week. This is going to be really, really interesting. Did you ever see the movie Yours, Mine, and Ours? There was one with Henry Fonda and Lucille Ball, and then a remake with Dennis Quaid and Rene Russo in 2005. Do you remember that movie, Michael?
I didn't see the remake, but I saw the original. Yes.
It fantastic. It's about a guy and a woman. The woman has 8 kids. The man has 10 kids, and they marry. And hilarity and love and family closeness ensues. And it was a great movie with Henry Fonda and Lucille Ball. The remake was good, too. It is just a good, uplifting movie based on a true story. And guess what? It's not based on a true story. We're going to have one of the children, who's now all grown up, he is going to talk about, his name is Tom North, and he comes from that famous family, and he's going to tell a whole different story than the Hollywood version of Yours, Mine, and Ours. He's going to tell how he survived the brutalness of his father. There was all kinds of abuse and coldness and horrible things going on, and he survived it. He wrote a book.
Surprise, surprise.
I know,
surprise,
what a shock.
Surprise.
And, you know, back then, if one of the kids would have spoken out, I don't think anybody would have paid attention. It would have been too shocking to write about. They wanted to keep this Hollywood image of this happy, fun family, you know, going, and it was anything but that. Now, Tom North has survived by learning transcendental meditation. He's going to talk a little bit about that, but he's also going to talk about his true life story, the true story of Yours, Mine, and Ours. And Michael will have all kinds of other true crime cases, whatever is out there. You know we will cover it. Right, sir?
Yes. I happen to read in the – we'll see Belvin Perry again if we hook up to that Rodriguez trial. If you recall, he was the judge in the case in the Anthony trial. He's apparently sitting on the Rodriguez trial.
I think next week we need to hook up to that, because I love him.
I did too. I liked him a lot.
He's a great guy. I'd like to take him out to lunch and just pick his brain. He is a wonderful judge. And we have a very special Trisha's True Crime Radio coming up on Tuesday. We're going to do it in the afternoon, 4 p.m. Eastern. It's a story about a missing man named Mark Driven, and we're going to talk about him. One of the thousands. What are you doing? Are you making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, Michael?
No.
What are you doing?
Not at all.
It sounds like you're hitting a bottle of ketchup.
No ketchup in my house, sorry.
Okay, I don't know what you're doing, but I can hear it. Are you doing dishes? I don't know what it is.
No,
don't tell me.
I'm not doing anything. I'm sorry.
Okay. Mark Driven is a missing man, one of thousands of missing people who don't get all of the attention that they deserve like the other people do. He's been missing for many, many years. We're going to talk to his cousin. Hopefully we'll have his father on the show, and that will be Tuesday. I'll have more up about this case in the next day or so to come. But we hope you'll join us, and that's a special edition of Trisha's True Crime Radio this Tuesday at 4 p.m. Michael, thank you, 4 p.m. Eastern, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Again, you're greatly appreciated for all your hard work, and I hope you'll join us on Tuesday, but I know you'll definitely join us next Sunday, right?
Absolutely.
All right, and do remember this, my darling angels. Opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests, and remember this as well. Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from websleuth.com, LLC, and forumsforjustice.org. In other words, if you hear something on this radio show that upsets your little mind, it upsets your body, it upsets your soul, you come to me, Trisha, and we'll make you happy again. You don't blame anybody on the forums, okay? Okay, it's Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss true crime and current events, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everybody.
Good night.